This is Through the Pickets, a podcast proudly brought to you by the New Zealand Cricket Players Association, where we showcase our members' interests, achievements and experiences either side of the white picket fence, with more of a lens on their off-field endeavours. Today's episode features a man whose career in cricket administration began with Northern Districts, before eventually becoming chair of New Zealand Cricket. From there, Greg Barclay pivoted into rugby league as the chair of the IRL, and in 2020, the Gisborne-born father of three was appointed to one of the top positions in world sport as the chair of the ICC. Greg Barclay, welcome to Through the Pickets. Thank you so much for making time to come on the podcast. Now, Greg, you are the current chair of the ICC. You were elected for the position in 2020, a two-year tenure. I guess the first question is, how have you found the last couple of years?
I think when people ask me that, I don't say it's difficult, because it's not. It's enjoyable, it's stimulating, it's interesting, and it's been particularly interesting, having that unique run through COVID where you couldn't travel, events were being disrupted and everything else that everybody around the world's experienced. But what I do describe it as is challenging, and it's challenging probably because you're talking about a world body, and bear in mind, I'm just a country boy from Gisborne, so my experience with the rest of the world is relatively limited. But you're dealing with sort of two things. There's a clash of cultures, whether that's driven out of geography, religion, colour, economics, or whatever. So balancing all of that and then overlay that with a really heavy dollop of self-interest, and managing a board of 17 people becomes, as I say, quite challenging at times. Certainly something very different to what I've ever experienced before. So, you learn, you tiptoe your way through the various nuances and the hurdles that get thrown up. But at the end of the day, I'm a Kiwi, and I think if you just stay true to your own values, if you look to do what's in the best interest of the organisation, you tend to end up somewhere that's there or thereabouts right. And that seems to be the case over the last couple of years. I think we've made reasonable progress. I don't think I've upset too many people, not to any great extent anyway. And we've certainly, I think, had some results.
I had this down at about question four, but seeing you've led into it, I did have, what are some of your biggest challenges? And you've touched on the diverse cultures, sovereignty issues. And of course, one of the big ones is, how do you manage a powerhouse nation like India?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing, and in my experience, I think one of the mistakes that people make dealing with India, and it may not just be India. I mean, if I use my experience on the Board of International Rugby League, Australia's similar across sport and across business. You have big dominant shareholders or stakeholders or whatever in your organisations. India is right at the end of that kind of extreme. They are very, very powerful. But I think rather than seeing that as an impediment to getting things done, I look at it from the point of view that we're actually really lucky to have India involved in the sport. What they bring in terms of size, scale, economics, playing resource, what they can provide in terms of the exotic side of the Asian experience, all those sort of things. That's an incredible benefit to the global game, to the world of cricket. So if you sort of think, well, gee, there's a lot there that we should be embracing, a lot that contributes to the good of the game, then it becomes a lot easier to look at the things that maybe are a bit more difficult to work through. But more than anything else, I think if you start from a position of respect and show them a degree of gratitude for what they do bring to the game, you'll find that, well, certainly I do, that they're relatively easy to talk to deal with. I mean, they've got their views, they've got their positions, and that's fine. Everyone has. Theirs obviously carry a little more influence than maybe some of the rest of us. But I look at it as a real positive for the game first and foremost. But they do take some managing. They have an inordinate influence, as I say, across the global game. But like all things, you solve most of your issues just through communication. So I've been fortunate. I've been to India. I've made an effort to go to India through my time with New Zealand Cricket once, probably more so twice a year. And I continue to do that. And it's amazing how many barriers get broken down, how you develop relationships if you actually turn up and have a cup of tea or go and have a curry and visit them in their homes and that sort of thing. It suddenly becomes, as I say, a lot easier to sit down and work through any particular issues. And it gives you a perspective as well. I mean, I'm not always right, just like they're not always right, but somewhere in between there's always a meeting point, and if you can get to that, then we're okay. So I haven't actually either had any particular problems with India or the BCCI.
Obviously, if you're a high-profile cricketer in India, you're a bit of a rock star. So, as the chair, if you go to India, is it like that for you? And I'm sorry, I'm being a curious George now.
No, it's not. I don't have nearly the profile or the following that the players do. But having said that, cricketers across that Southern Asian area, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, it's massive. I don't think that in this part of the world we understand just, how much cricket means to them and the following that the sport gets. So as a consequence of that, you do probably get treated differently to the way that I would in New Zealand, where we're very egalitarian. If I need to get to Eden Park, I jump in a taxi or get a ride or whatever. Whereas in India, there'd be someone in the car there to pick me up, probably waiting an hour before I need to leave, and I'd be driven right into the back door of the stadium and escorted up to wherever I'm going. So yeah, it is different without a doubt. And it's hierarchical. They would perceive that my position, as the chair of the ICC, puts me near the apex of the organisation, and I get accorded some sort of status that's supposedly commensurate with that position. So yeah, I do notice that it is different when I'm in those countries, and I know that guys like Heath and whatever just laugh about the way that I do get treated. But look, I take it for what it is. It's it's part of the office. It's it changes when I come home. My wife will remind me very quickly that I might be the head of the Board of World Cricket, but I'm certainly not head of this household, so I behave like everybody else does. I get grounded pretty quickly.
Greg, if I read this right, your term ends in November. You're allowed to do 3 terms in total, so 6 years. Would you be keen to do another term? Have you put your hand up for another term, or can it roll over automatically? Do you mind explaining how it works?
Yeah, no, certainly explain. We're actually, funny enough, in the process at the moment. So the way it works is that constitutionally we've got a 2-year term. The role of the chair is independent. So to get there under the constitution, you need to be a past or present director of the ICC. And directors nominate people for the position of chair. So at the moment, we're funny enough in that nomination process for the second 2-year term. I've said unequivocally that I'm very happy to carry on if the board sees that there's value by me remaining. I think I've got a reasonable amount of support around the board, so I'm happy that my name has gone forward. I have been nominated, and as of last night, ironically enough, the nomination process closed. So I'm aware, although it hasn't been confirmed, that there may be one other candidate. I don't know who it is at this stage, and it'll be a few days before the independent oversight committee tells me who that is when they come back and seek my confirmation that I'm prepared to go to the next stage. But if it all plays out, we will vote in November on the day before the final. We've got an ICC board meeting there, and we'll do the vote and see how things go. If I get a simple majority, I'm back for another 2 years, which I'm quite looking forward to having an opportunity to do.
It's not like an episode of Survivor or anything, is it? Where you got like little alliances and stuff like that. I've dumbed it down a little bit,
It kind of is.
yeah.
There's plenty of factionalism and politicking, and I think going back to what we were talking about, Dennis, that's a little bit of the perhaps the difference in culture. That's inherent in, I'm generalizing here, but Asia, Africa, maybe, where they do into politic and talk and sidle up and do things. Doesn't make it right, wrong, or whatever. It's just different. Whereas I think here we're a lot more reticent about doing that. We tend to, say, well, yeah, there's my record, there's my background, you make the decision. Whereas they're a lot more proactive in terms of promoting the people that they see as the right appointments. And to be honest, they're not necessarily motivated by performance or capability or competence. Often it's more about the politics and the personality. So depending on what factions are looking for at whatever time, which factions are better connected than others, you tend to get certain people that appear as potential candidates. And often you look at it and go, really? How does that happen? But that is the outcome of what is just a very, very different cultural process and cultural approach, really. So, our Western liberal supposed best practice governance style is not necessarily one that's adopted by a lot of other countries around the world. And I think that's one of the things you've got to appreciate really early on is that, the lens that we see things through in New Zealand, Australia, maybe England, are not the way that that lens works in, as I say, other parts of the world, which is also what makes it quite fascinating from my point of view as well.
Greg, how did you become chair of the ICC?
My background, I played a bit of cricket and really enjoyed it, and a little bit of Hawke Cup kind of stuff, senior club cricket over the years, bit of club stuff in England. Came back to Auckland as a lawyer at that point in my life where I thought, I need to get semi-serious and stick at a real job and whatnot. But I kept playing cricket. In fact, I played until I was in my early 40s. And when I stopped, I kind of just I didn't lose interest in the game, but I guess, I had kids and I had a career that was, probably at that stage where it was moving pretty quickly. And I just fell out of the game, really. I just didn't have an involvement. And about 3 years later, my brother was doing a bit of work with David Cooper, who was the CEO of Northern Districts Cricket. And he sort of mentioned, your brother might be interested in having a look at one of these roles. We're looking to appoint one or two independent directors to the board. And so he came back and said, what do you reckon? When me being a fishhead would be the last thing that I'd consider. And anyway, we're actually having a beer and we kicked it around. And I'd done a bit of sports law and sports related stuff in my legal career. I actually had an interest in a little event management company that was doing quite a lot of, and still does, a lot of corporate hospitality around sports events, the big marquees on the backfield at rugby tests and the lounge stuff and all the rest of it. So I'd seen sport from the commercial side as well, but I hadn't done that third part of the triangle, that third leg of the triangle, which was administration. So I thought it'd be good for me to see the sport from that side. And I'm lucky. I mean, I certainly didn't play to the very top level, but cricket and sport's given me a lot. And I thought that it's also an opportunity to give something back. So anyway, long story short, I did apply for the role, and I got appointed. And I thought, well, it was a 3 year term. Used to drive down to Hamilton most months for my evening board meeting, and I quite enjoyed it. And it was a good time at Northern Districts Cricket because the team were performing well. Seddon Park was a dedicated cricket ground with lights, and it was sort of the only facility like that in the country. So we got quite a bit of international content as a consequence. Good youth programs and good talent identification, and obviously the high performance side was okay because that era that I went through produced players like Tim Southee and Kane Williamson, Trent Boult, BJ Watling, Corey Anderson, Ish Sodhi. So it was really cool being involved in that era. Towards the end, I think 2011, we actually won the double, the Ford Trophy and the Plunkett Shield that year. So it was a good time to be involved in the sport, and it was also changing really quickly because T20 didn't exist when I first joined the ND board back then, and it was starting to catch on and move quite quickly. And it was a phenomenon that none of us really understood and didn't really know in terms of the high performance side how to play the game, how to play the game to consistently win, and certainly didn't know how to manage it off the field. So that was all a massive learning experience. And right in the middle of that came the Indian leagues. There was the ICL followed by the IPL through that period. So that sort of really supercharged the T20 game as well. So that made it quite exciting. And I guess that was, really the consolidating part of the game going professional as well. I think New Zealand players had only been true professionals for maybe 5 years by the time I went to the ND board. So we're all learning about that as well and, evolving and developing.
Well, I know you did another stint at ND and ended up as chair there, but then you moved on to NZC in what was one of the most challenging times in the game.
It's a long story, Dennis. Sorry, you cut me off pretty much. You might recall, and I know you've spoken to some of the integral players or participants from this period of time in New Zealand cricket, but it wasn't a great period, 2011, 12, 13. And at ND we were reasonably, I guess, vocal about some of the things that we saw as shortcomings at New Zealand cricket. It was impacting us in some respects, and we sort of pushed hard for change. We thought that the game was owed that, and as a consequence, a few of the people at ND said, why don't you go to the New Zealand board? And back in those days, you used to get nominated as a potential director of New Zealand cricket by the NAs. That system's long gone, fortunately. But anyway, I was the last ever under that system to be nominated from an NA to the New Zealand board. You still went through an independent selection panel and still had to get through that gate. But fortunately, I did. They must have seen something in me. Maybe they decided I was better inside the tent than outside it and brought me in. I'm not sure. But so in 2012, I joined the New Zealand board, and quite literally, I was there for one short meeting after the AGM when I first got ratified. And then my first full board meeting dealt with the change of captaincy and all of that saga. And it was just quite extraordinary just to suddenly be almost in the eye of the storm. And whilst that wasn't the cause maybe of New Zealand cricket's problems or issues, it was certainly a catalyst to bring the issues to the fore. And to the credit of the chair at the time, Chris Moller, he said, we need to take this seriously. There's a governance review that was underway, and he said that we needed to fast track that. We need to look closely at the recommendations, and that's what did happen. So we almost as an organisation broke, which in hindsight was really good because it gave us an opportunity to actually build it properly from the beginning. We didn't just tinker or tweak some of the parts that maybe could have been window dressed or papered over. So, it was fundamental in terms of the way that review recommendation or set of recommendations was implemented. And I think that you can see quite quickly the benefits of having done that. We ended up with an independent board. We had a CEO that was properly resourced and directed in terms of execution. High performance became really important because, when I got there, you were 10 four-member countries, and I think that we were ranked 8 out of 9 out of those across the three forms of the game. So we were kind of bottom of the barrel. Whereas, shortly, 36 months later, we were in a World Cup final and ranked, consistently from there forward in the top three or four of all forms of the game. And obviously that culminated with the World Test Championship win. So, things did change. And there were a lot of other pleasing things that came out of that. The women's game was suddenly recognised as needing a lot of help. And, we got on and did that. And whilst there's a long way to go, that helped. The game got resourced properly. We really looked at the financial base and how we could change that. That meant we took an international focus around what we did. So it was a really, really exciting time to be involved in the game. And coming off a low base, I guess the view was that, we could only really go up. And fortunately, that is what happened.
So, Greg, not only did you find yourself in the eye of the storm, as you put it, you're also part of reforming the constitution of New Zealand cricket, and the 2015 Cricket World Cup was just around the corner as well.
I think I've been two years on the board at the time. And I was lucky with Don McKinnon. I was, with my legal background, I actually was part of the two-man constitutional review group. So I had a real bird's-eye view at what was happening in terms of changing the way that we govern the organisation moving forward. But we had the co-hosting rights to the Men's 2015 World Cup. And because of the shakeout at board level and the fact that the board resigned shortly after my very first meeting, I thought I might be one of the shortest-serving directors ever of New Zealand. I got, I reapplied and I got back, and Stu Hill, who was the chair, and he is a great guy, Stu. And he said, look, Greg, you've got some event background, you've got some commercial skills, supposedly. I'm going to suggest that you join the Cricket World Cup board. So I did that. So suddenly I'm part of a co-host, an Australian New Zealand co-hosted event, which was, a real eye-opener as well, great experience. And it got me sort of involved with the Aussies, and I got to know some of them, and they were quite powerful at the ICC. It's back in those days, India, Australia and England kind of had key positions at the ICC. And as a result of that, Martin Sneddon, who had been at the ICC as New Zealand's rep, he got a job with Duco, actually, and because of his commitments there, he couldn't travel to ICC meetings. So Stu said, well, Greg, you sort of know the Aussies and you've seen a bit of the international stuff. Why don't you go and take Martin's place at the ICC? So 2014, suddenly I'm, the guy that was going to do one term at NB, I'm now, on the New Zealand World Cup board, and I'm off to the ICC as well. And I had no idea how it worked and what happened, but I turned up and sort of took the typical Kiwi approach and sat there and listened and learned and tried to talk to a few people and build some relationships. And over the years, that's kind of what happened. And I think New Zealand's always recognized as an honest broker in those situations, and we got on pretty well with most people. So when COVID came around, we had a few issues at board level. It was quite dysfunctional. The chair had left pretty suddenly, Shashank Menaha from India. Yeah, just internally there were a few ructions. So there was a quite a series of in-depth conversations, and they decided that we'd have a look at new chair and trying to shake things up. So a few of the guys came and talked to me and said, "Greg, you should consider taking on the chair." And I was very much of the view, I said, "Yeah, I'm not remotely interested in doing this. One, because I enjoy my role at New Zealand Cricket. Two, I think that we've got more, well, there is more for us to do at NZC. Three, I come from a small four member country, so I don't know that I'll have the gravitas to necessarily be taken seriously in that role. And finally, I'm a long, long way away from Dubai, so I can't just hop on a plane and 3 hours later, be in the office." Anyway, they seemed to think that none of that was too much of an issue, and on that basis, I agreed to let my name go forward if I thought there was sufficient support. And I explained the process to you for voting. So we went through first round and went through. And in those days, or that last round, you had to get a two-third majority. And India threw their weight behind me, and I think that might have converted one or two other countries, and I got the two-third majority. And 2 years ago, there you go, I'm suddenly now chair of the ICC. So that's my journey.
Wow, that's just absolutely, that's incredible. So you've got the next couple of event cycles coming up for the ICC, like selling a couple of World Cups. Is there some good news on the horizon for the sport?
Yeah, I think we've done the men's event for two cycles, two four-year cycles, so 8 years. And funny enough, Martin Sneddon, and I had him chairing the events allocation committee, and Sourav Ganguly was on that, and Ricky Skerritt from the West Indies. I think they did a great job. They got a really good balance between trying to maximise commercial outcomes, so a heavy Asian and Indian allocation, but they also stayed quite true to the strategic plan, which has obviously got a strong pillar around the global growth of the game. So we've spread events around places like the US, West Indies, some of the maybe the not so featured Asian countries, Bangladesh. Africa's got a World Cup. They haven't had the high profile men's event for quite a while. So I think we've got a really good mix of allocation, and as I say, I think a pretty good opportunity to maximize commercial outcomes. And then the women's side of it, we've only done 4 years around that, and in part because it's growing so quickly now. I think to try and anticipate what it might look like even 4 years forward is slightly fraught. It's just so much potential. So we've locked in 4 years worth of allocation for the women's game. Again, part of the reason also for that is we think that commercially it will stand on its two feet quite neatly. So to give an opportunity for that as well, I think it's really, really important. So yeah, I think pretty much it's all good news. Seems to be really, really well received from the members, from the commercial stakeholders, and I think the fans as well. I mean, if I'm not getting emails and whatnot telling me that I've got it all wrong, then I'm generally assuming that it's all pretty good. So yeah, as I say, I think it's good. And I guess we're fortunate as well in that cricket's, if you believe that it's the world's second most popular team sport, and it's growing a lot, it's growing quickly, and it's growing in parts. It's not just all organic growth out of the traditional areas, South Asia and whatnot. Parts of Africa and the US and the Americas and that sort of thing. The sport's coming along, and then there are other parts of the globe where the women's game is actually charging ahead. Probably even more so in some of those countries, Thailand and Malaysia, more so than the men's game. So yeah, it's a good time for cricket at the moment, and the task for all of us as administrators and stakeholders in the game is just to make sure that we're continuing to allow that growth to continue and supporting it.
Greg, when I was in sports broadcasting, everything used to be bundled. You'd pay for the men's, and you'd have to take the women's and the juniors and the under 20s, etc. So was the debundling or selling things separately, what's the story behind that?
Well, I guess the best example I can give you is just our recent broadcast rights sale, which was done only for the men's event, and it was a bit of a, I guess, a leap into the dark to the extent that we break away from the way that it was traditionally done, as you say, just on a bundled basis. So we separated men's and women's for the first time ever, We took the men's rights to, or the rights to the men's events to market, but we broke the world out into regions, India being the obvious one. And then we've got the UK, we've got the America, well, USA, Australia, New Zealand, Africa, and sort of MENA, Middle East, and North Africa. So we're only at the front end of that. We've done India, and as I say, we're, both the breaking out of, I guess, or the unbundling of the arrangements, plus the way that we went to market, which is very different to the way the BCCI did the IPL. I guess, viewed a little bit of trepidation because it was new, but the fact is that we got sort of twice what we expected out of the Indian market just for the men's rights alone, and we also split the cycle so you could actually take a 4 year or an 8 year cycle. We put a multiplier just to give the broadcasters a clue as to what the relative differentiation between the values were, but they all plumped for 4 years. Nobody actually had a crack at taking the 8 years, so that was interesting as well. So I think the market's changed, but what was also interesting around that, and you'll probably know better than I, given your broadcast background, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, certainly when I was sort of in the second half of my NZC period, there was a real strong view that digital was going to almost supplant traditional broadcast as a the way to take your rights to your audience. Whereas I think what we've seen is actually, that quite hasn't happened. I think broadcast has stayed really firm. In fact, if anything, it's maybe consolidated its position. Streaming is still going to be massively important, but I don't think that, it's sort of, as I say, suppressed the traditional broadcast market at all. So yeah, we're really interested to see that trend. And there are a couple of the big streaming players that in the end didn't pitch for our Indian rights, which again was a surprise. But all of the usual suspects out of the broadcast or the linear television market all threw their hats in the ring. So a lot of interest, and more things change, maybe then will they stay the same? I don't know.
Player associations play a prominent role in sport here in New Zealand. Some other countries, not so much. What's your personal view on player associations and the role that they play?
As Heath knows, I've always been a big supporter of the players' associations. We don't have a game if we don't have players, and the players have a vested set of rights and properties that need to be both protected and enhanced. But I think that players' associations are ideally placed to do that, coupled with the fact that there are a whole lot of issues around integrity and welfare and career and certainly post-playing career that need to be considered. And the cricket bodies, the home boards, whilst they could provide a lot of that, you just end up with an inherent conflict. And the reality is that they will always be regarded, New Zealand cricket, Australian cricket, the ECB, whatever, as being the establishment. And there is simply isn't that element of trust for the players to, I think, believe that they're getting maximum support around those issues of proprietary rights and being looked after from an integrity point of view, all of those sort of things. Whereas what we're better to do is to properly resource an independent body, a players' association, to do that. And I think one of the great misnomers, and maybe it's the fault of the home boards, is that I don't think the roles of the players' associations, probably in most sports, are really properly understood. They'll still be viewed by the man in the street as a glorified former union that just comes along every now and then when they do the next round of negotiations and try to push the price up. Whereas, that is an aspect of their role for sure, but it's so much not the bigger part of it. So I think that, from my point of view, I think they perform a an essential role and a very credible role in sport. So I'm unabashedly I'm a fan of them, and to be honest, I quite like the positive tension that comes out of the organisation that I'm representing versus the organisation that is representing the players. I think it's a healthy tension, and it keeps there's a system of checks and balances in there. And it's symbiotic. One can't actually exist without the other. So reaching that point tends to, by the time everyone's had their say and you've had out your arm wrestle and thrashed it out and thrown insults at each other and all the rest of it, you tend to land, I always thinking about the right place. So as I say, I think that tension's, really, really healthy for the game. And for me, it's reflected in, I think, the relationship that New Zealand cricket has with the players. And I've always been well treated by the players. If I'm away anywhere, they're, very quick to include me. They're very friendly. There's no animosity or barrier there at all. And you've got to give credit to, in New Zealand's case, Heath and his team for having achieved that. So yeah, I you know I think that they're an essential part of the game, and the sooner that we all recognise it, the better. I understand that culturally it's not necessarily the way that it might be viewed in other parts of the world, and I think you can sort of see quite clearly the divide in cricket as to where you've got the associations and where you haven't. It's not to say that their systems don't work or don't deliver outcomes for their players, but I can only speak from my experience. So I think that the game's well served by having dynamic, well-resourced players' associations.
It must be quite different sitting on the board of a commercial entity versus a sporting organisation.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about sport, and I sit on the boards of, commercial organisations, and their stakeholder group or group of the stakeholder interest in that is very narrow. And generally, it's looking at one outcome, and that is, what sort of profit are you going to derive for your shareholders at the end of the year? So your strategies and your motivations are quite specific and, as I said, quite narrow. Whereas one of the great things about sport, it's also one of the things that makes sport really difficult to administer, is that you have a huge number of disparate stakeholders in the game. And sport's really lucky that it does that. It's got a huge amount of interest in following if it's doing the basics correctly. But I could go to my local on a Friday night, and I noticed when I first got on the board in New Zealand cricket, no one talked to me about, Greg, what sort of week did you have in the law firm? And for 25 years, no one had asked me that question. But gee, I was, dialed up about cricket issues. There'd be people I didn't even know would come up and go, "Hey, you were at New Zealand cricket. Why did this happen? Or why don't you do that? Or how come this guy's not picked?" And so it's one of the sort of interesting aspects of sport is that huge stakeholder group from the guy, at the corner of the bar who, he's an owner of that team. He is, he is genuinely a part of it. And the moment you fail to recognize that, you're in all sorts of trouble. And that runs all the way through your major broadcaster and your big sponsors and your local authorities that provide the grounds and your stadium operators that give you the venues and all the rest of it. There is a massive group of people that are involved in the delivering of any sports event. And balancing all that is, it's difficult, but it's also really interesting as well.
Greg, challenges you see in the game over the next 5, 10 years, both internationally and any issues for cricket here in New Zealand?
Yeah, well, certainly if you break it down country by country, in the areas, the regions that we're familiar with, we have a massive drop off of kids, around that 12, 13, 14 sort of age group. And evidence will show you that if you lose them, you don't get them back. So that's a, that is a real challenge for sport, and cricket's no different at all. It's there's so much out there for kids to do now, from skateboards to computer games to everything else that they're doing. And why would they necessarily stand around in the hot sun for hours on end, without even getting a batter or bowl or whatever? So we need to, as much as the traditionalists will probably hate me saying this, but we need to evolve the game to ensure that it's contemporary for, the kids and youths of today. I think understanding the involvement of females in the game, we still haven't got that right. We've probably still got too much of an orientation toward the male view of the game. And I think that, yeah, that doesn't mean to say we need to get more females involved in the running of the game, but we certainly do need to get more females involved in the running of the game. But I think we need to do better at winning the hearts and minds of females to make them attracted to cricket. So that is a big challenge because, it's a complex game and it's not cheap to play it. You need quite a big space, and you need, other, you need a pitch and that sort of thing, as well as the equipment you've got. So that doesn't necessarily lend itself to, all sectors of society. I think that as much as we love the tradition of the game, we get too wedded in the tradition as well. I mean, if I look at, I'm a father of girls, all my girls actually played cricket, and that is different from the way that the boys played. And, do I care if they turn up in pink leotards or whatever they want to do? As long as they're playing the game, that's all that matters. I'm not sure that a strict adherence on whites or whatever, especially whites that are the same as the boys wear, is a prerequisite for them playing the game. So a lot of challenges at societal level and that sort of age and stage level. There's obviously a resourcing thing. You do need to have a big hunk of ground, and not all cities necessarily can provide that. Whereas you look at basketball, how quickly it grows, but you just need a hoop on a brick wall, and you can have a game of three a side or whatever. So basketball can work almost anywhere. Football's a bit the same. Get a strip of ground somewhere and you can play it. But cricket's not quite the same. So there is that. A lot of competition now amongst regions or regional areas, cities, whatever, to provide cricket facilities. So you've got that. And another thing is that we live in an age of instant gratification. So to have hours dedicated to cricket is difficult. People work, they've got a number of other things to do. Weekends are sacrosanct. That's all changing. And again, the sport needs to change with it. It's not changing quickly enough. So we fall through the cracks there, and that will get worse, not better, unless we do make changes. And then I think, again, in New Zealand, I'm just picking off some obvious things. When I grew up, cricket was a game that traditionally was played in summer in schools, whereas now it's not. And if you don't have that catchment at school level, with the teachers being involved in it and the sport being provided for at the school, you've got to put it somewhere else. And there is no somewhere else at the moment apart from clubs. But outside of the big metro areas, Auckland, Christchurch, maybe, it's very hard to do that. The clubs don't cater for anything other than at that senior sort of level. So we've got all of that in front of us. Then extrapolate that out onto the world stage. The big threat and the big opportunity, I think, is around female participation. There are a lot of countries out there that don't really recognise women's sport in the same way that they do men's sport. So, but it's an opportunity as well. But that is problematic, for sure. But despite all that, the sport is growing fast. There is massive opportunity. And I guess that's one of the things that the ICC can and should be doing, is to facilitate that global growth. You can't grow cricket in every country. There'll be regions or countries that will get picked as winners, and there'll be better investment out of that as we do look to grow the game. But yeah, as I say, it's a series of, I guess, threats and opportunities out there for the sport.
You touched on it a little bit, but I was going to ask you about the conundrum of evolution, which you talked about the game evolving and the instant gratification. And then you've got cricket purists and people that are really steadfast on the tradition, and particularly in women's cricket. You must get asked this a lot about women's test cricket. You're looking at this evolution of the game's going to faster, faster, faster. How do you placate the purists versus the evolution of the game?
Well, I think the first thing from my perspective is that we've got to regard ourselves as incredibly fortunate that we've been able to develop a third form of the game that is now effectively paying the bills. It's subsidising the two more traditional forms, which is great because cricket it's unique. There's nothing like Test cricket played anywhere in the world, and it's got an incredible legacy, history, tradition. And you'd never want to lose that. Why would you want to lose almost the essential spirit of the game? So I think it's really important that we do what we can to ensure that Test cricket endures. But you're right, it is very, very difficult to justify economically the sport outside of a handful of countries. So England, Australia, India, maybe South Africa, but even a well-performing Test country like New Zealand at the moment is effectively propping up test cricket from a financial point of view. The broadcasters will show graphs with one line going this way and one going that way, and the one going up is not test cricket, it's going the other way. I think that the fallacy that was so promulgated a few years ago that you couldn't play short form until you learned to play long form properly has been well dispelled. You just look at it, Dave Warner or someone like that who came along and smashed it from day one in T20 and then went on to become a pretty useful test player. So I don't think that holds true from a high performance point of view anymore either. But yeah, as I say, I think that we're really lucky to have all three forms of the game. And as members and as a world body, we're trying to do what we can. We've got the World Test Championship now to get a little bit of context and relevance around tests and test series. So suddenly, there's a bit of jeopardy. If you lose points, you might not get through to the final in that 2 year period. But it does require the members. These are all bilateral arrangements, and the members themselves have to commit to long form cricket, test cricket. And I think the same is absolutely true of the women's game as well. There is no reason that women can't be playing test cricket, so long as the member boards are supportive of that. They've got room in the calendar and they can resource it. But the fact is, not many countries actually can resource it. That is just an economic reality. Most of them are really, really struggling with it, from Afghanistan, Ireland, Zimbabwe through to, South Africa and whatever. So outside of really those big three, we struggle to do that. So unless the ICC or some other form of financial support is going to be provided to enable Test cricket to continue, then really everyone is going to gravitate toward the shorter form because it pays the bills, as well as, and let's not lose sight of the fact that that's where the fans see the game at the moment as well. You put a T20 on and you'll get close to a full ground or stadium. A test match is hard to sell. Again, there are the obvious exceptions being the Ashes and one or two others, but even in India, they're not getting anywhere near capacity grounds at test matches. So, we've got to recognize that there's no point playing an ostrich and sticking our heads in the sand. That is the way that the game is evolving. So let's accept that to keep the essential essence of cricket, that it needs subsidising, it needs support. But it always did. This is not a new thing. Gee, when Test cricket was the only form of the game, it still needed for in a lot of places to be resourced and propped up. That came from various sources, government funding or wherever it might have been. But there was no broadcast money in those days. It's a relatively recent development outside of the UK for money to be pouring into the game and the players to be paid and all the rest of it. So, yeah, that's a hodgepodge kind of approach, I guess. But I think strategically, all three forms of the game are really important. We should maintain them, but just accept that, we need to evolve and we need to change as we're going. And, gee, Test cricket has changed constantly over the course of its history, from timeless tests and uncovered pitches and, 8 ball overs and all the rest of it to become what it has now. And it will change again. There's nothing wrong with that. Pink ball tests and day night tests and all the rest of things. I think it's good. It's healthy, but at least we've still got test cricket. And I think that's really important. It'll be a sad day where, everyone gets together and says, test cricket's a now a thing of the past.
I also noticed you've been involved with other sports.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, I'd had a reasonable involvement in rugby. Just I played, obviously, I'm a Kiwi boy and growing up in Gisborne. So, Gisborne boys, there was, rugby and that was it. You could play soccer, I think, if there was some reason you couldn't play rugby, and that was really about it. But and when I was at Gizzy Boys, it was, it was great because pretty much every boy was expected to play sport at school. You were, and there was rugby in the winter and cricket in the summer. So I kind of came through that system. So yeah, rugby, loved the game, played it, and whatever. And I did a bit of work as a lawyer around rugby, particularly when it became professional, and had the involvement. In fact, the firm still provides, the Blues their legal work, and so I've had a reasonable involvement in that experience group. But I guess I just saw an opportunity. There was a previous iteration of a company called Capital Events, but I've probably seen enough in sport to realise that there was a business in sport, but not necessarily looking after players and player contracts, and at times being a glorified babysitter, but looking at sort of the broader kind of gambit across that, and sort of just fell into a bit of an opening, and it grew to become, an event management company with a real heavy emphasis on corporate hospitality. And it did some big gigs. We did the 2005 Lions. I think there were something like 30,000 people hosted across venues through all of the matches through that. 2011 World Cup, Bledisloe Tests, and on sevens in the early days when it was big down in Wellington. It was a lot of fun, so it was great being involved in it.
So from the 15-man version, you went to the 13-man version. How did you get involved with rugby league?
It was pure serendipity. I was actually in London. It was the day before the 2019 World Cup final. I was at Lord's I was with Dave White watching the team train that afternoon, and I bumped into a guy called Richard Stenhouse, who runs a sports recruitment business. Hey, Greg, I've been meaning to talk to you. I've got this role coming up with International Rugby League. They're looking for, doing some governance change, all the stuff that you know about. Would you be interested? I went, nah, not remotely. He sort of badged me, and I thought, actually, that sport is different for me. It's something that I haven't had a background in or much experience with. It's completely different sort of demographic, and everything about it is just different. But I've always enjoyed the sport. I'm like most Kiwis. I've watched the Warriors, and since I've been a kid, I'd love those 70s and 80s league tests and whatever. So I thought, it'll be good. So, I did apply, and I ended up being appointed as the first independent chair of the organisation.
In your time at the ICC, what would you like to achieve for the game?
I don't want to do anything differently, and it's actually not about me. It's actually about the organisation and making sure that the ICC continues to deliver against its strategic imperatives, that it continues to support members, that it genuinely grows the game for all people that are interested in cricket, regardless of where you come from, your background, or your gender, or your ethnicity. I think that that's really important. And as I say, that can only be done through a team effort. It's not about me and what I can contribute. All I can do is try to make sure that I can help facilitate, the direction that the organisation's going in. But I always measure these things as the organisation a better one when you leave than it was when you started. And I would think, and I would hope that the ICC, just as New Zealand Cricket was, that they're better organisations, when I leave than they were when I started. And if I can say that, then I think, hopefully I played some small part in helping to achieve that.
You got much on your plate in the next little while?
Yeah, I'd probably set some fairly lofty goals for the organisation. A couple of big things in front of me, obviously now that we know that we've got the money flowing in for the next cycle, we've got to allocate it. And building an investment model, which is the way I regard it, the board will probably talk about a distribution model, but I think we should be allocating that money properly so that, it's being used wisely to help meet our objectives. But that is because we're driven by self-interest, as all sports organisations are. So, India wanting a bigger share right through to the smallest associates wanting more help, and everything in between, including all of those members that struggle to play test cricket and field teams at all levels of the game or whatever, there'll be a real dogfight for a share of that kind of pie. So building that investment model is going to be really, really challenging. So I'm keen to have a crack at that and to see where we might get to. And I really do want to see a perceptible change in the level of the women's game as well. I just think that, that's, again, got so much potential, and we could move really quickly to getting the women's game, somewhere up sort of at level, not necessarily from a fan following or whatever, but a lot of the metrics, could put it to a point where it's sitting, reasonably equal in terms of parity with the men's game. So, I'd like to see some real improvement in that in the next couple of years as well. And I think that's easily achieved, to be honest, so long as there's a will to do it. And it's interesting because once we do that, I think it's an easy time for me to maybe step aside, because we'll move from building, spending 2-3 years building for the next cycle into an execution phase, and somebody else can pick that up and do that. It's a perfect time for that for the next next year and the next team to maybe get in there and look to do that.
Greg Barclay, thank you so much for coming on Through the Pickets and giving up your time. Best of luck with the upcoming elections at the ICC, your travels to the ICC T20 World Cup, and of course the summer ahead, and then that massive portfolio of work that you've got to do.
Yeah, no, it's been brilliant, Dennis. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, all the best for you guys down at the CPA. You do a great job, and look forward to catching up with you all soon.
Through the Pickets is an NZCPA production. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and our members, make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our website, nzcpa.co.nz. If you liked our podcast, please do take a minute to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. I'm Dennis Katsanos, and you've been listening to Through the Pickets.